The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Scott Curran. Scott is the founder of Beyond Advisors, a consulting firm that works with social innovators, nonprofits, philanthropists, governments, and private sector leaders to design and build their organizations and initiatives for impact. Prior to starting Beyond Advisors, Scott served as general counsel for the Clinton Foundation, leading a legal team that supported the global operating charity with over 2,000 staff and volunteers in 36 countries on dozens of initiatives. Shockingly, the one thing that's missing from Scott's official biography is that he's a proud graduate of the Second City Training Center. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kelly, and I will absolutely fix that.
Thank you. I promise that most of this conversation will be about the work you're doing with Beyond Advisors, but there's been so much attention on your former place of employment, the Clinton Foundation, that I did want to ask you about your experience going from what I'll call traditional office politics to politics as the foundation of the office you were in.
Sure. It was an exciting journey that resulted in a big yes and in my own life. So it's a fair question, and I'm super proud of the work that I did at the Clinton Foundation and that the Clinton Foundation has done and continues to do, so I'm all too happy to talk about it. But I will start by noting that it is absolutely philanthropy through and through, and very little in the actual capital P politics.
Yeah, right? Yeah. All right, so you didn't have to deal with that much politics. You were dealing with your day-to-day business.
For the better part of my 10 years with them, big P politics were not a part of the day-to-day. Obviously, in the later years, and part of the reason I chose to leave was because I knew that as a member of the family pursued her most recent political endeavor, that there would be inevitable attention on the foundation that would require, you know, a defensive posture, which was not my interest in being at the foundation at the beginning and certainly wasn't at the end either, which is part of my exit.
Okay, so one more question on this, and then we'll jump to the other. Problem. Is what was working with Bill Clinton like?
Awesome, in one word. Day to day, it wasn't. You know, he wasn't in the office having pizza with staff on a regular basis. But everything we were doing started from the time when it was named the William J. Clinton Foundation. In later years, it became the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. So I got to see the evolution of a dynamic, globally operating charity, which was in and of itself an interesting process and very fun to be a part of, especially in my role as counsel. But in the early years of what I would call a golden era in global philanthropy, where we saw the likes of Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, Richard Branson, even Lance Armstrong pre-scandal, people who rose to prominence doing something different than what they chose to do with their later years or their work in philanthropy, making that pivot in their own life towards purpose when any and all of them could have just sat back, counted their money, played golf, or done whatever they wanted to do, for those people to instead pursue very challenging, very difficult, very bold and audacious goals, often working together with the time, talent, and treasure that they could uniquely bring together, was the experience of a lifetime.
I bet.
And coming from a corporate legal background where I worked with businesses and other organizations that were in growth stages or making pivots, to be able to take that skill set and then apply it in a place where the work was so immediately transformative and impactful and meaningfully changed people's lives. And we saw the efforts of it in real time, whether it was post-disaster, whether it was working on issues of the day from HIV/AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis, climate change, early childhood education, women and girls, empowerment, childhood obesity in the United States. The work we did mattered, still matters, and it was fascinating. As a lawyer who never saw this coming in my own life or career, to be a part of that growth stage during that time of the mid or early 2000s into the 2010s.
Yeah. You have a terrific blog on the Beyond Advisors website, and I wanted to ask you about this quote from one of your recent pieces. You wrote that, quote, "Corporate social responsibility is increasingly taking a backseat to social impact initiatives." What's the difference?
CSR has traditionally been what businesses do with their profits to achieve social good. So after the business is done and they've earned their revenue, they go and do something good with it. Mm-hmm. They can donate that to somebody else. They can create their own charity. I always use Ronald McDonald House as a good example. They make the money selling the burgers and the food, and then they take some of those profits and do amazing work through the Ronald McDonald House. But that's with profits. Social impact and social innovation is more frequently becoming associated with how you use the business model to do good and do well.
Hmm.
And we're seeing that with increasing frequency. It's real. And I think the most innovative businesses, organizations, nonprofits, governments are finding ways to incorporate social good into what they do as part of their day-to-day business. And it's an incredibly exciting area.
So what you're talking about is, like, rather than purpose after profits, it's actually you can do purpose and profits together.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
okay.
The most common is Tom's Shoes, or the one-for-one model that they pioneered, which has its critics and there's fair conversations to have there. But inherent in their business model is we're going to do good with our profits and business model while we do well selling them for a profit.
And, you know, you're a lawyer.
I am.
And
proudly.
We're great. And we're gonna tell some lawyer jokes later, by the way.
Love it.
Which was actually not taken from, like, a joke book. It was taken from a real academic paper. So I'm foreshadowing. But you actually talk about, and there's a quote of yours, that lawyers' involvement is typically passive. And you ask the question, what does it look like if we put lawyers in front of the social innovation movement? What do you mean by that?
Lawyers are, by their nature, service providers, myself included. So we are responsive to client demands. In the traditional schema of law firms, which is not the entire practice of law, to be sure, clients typically come to their lawyers while a deal has matured, or while an issue has matured, or after a problem has arisen.
The let's pass it by legal thing at the end.
Make sure you run it by legal, or the divorce is imminent, now we should go to the lawyer.
Right.
And that's a natural part of it. The service delivery model is set up that way for a great number of the consumers of legal services. When you work in-house, it's a different model. And so I saw for 10 years working for a growth stage nonprofit with a really high profile and lots of opportunity and resources, the process that involved lawyers from the front end. I didn't start as a lawyer at the Clinton Foundation. I started actually as an intern looking at pervasively poor rural America and opportunities to potentially explore programming in that area. And then we accidentally started the legal department one day when somebody walked by and said, "You're a lawyer, read this." And I took that as an invitation. But in that work, the lawyers are brought in pretty close to day one. You know, whether there was an earthquake in Haiti, whether there's a new initiative that somebody has an idea about, whether some interesting strategic partner or government leader came and said, "Hey, we think you can uniquely help us in this issue," the program teams typically involved our team early on in that process. And I didn't realize that when it was happening. I mean, obviously knew I was doing the work, but I realized after the fact that that beautiful design build process involved the lawyers on the front end.
Mm-hmm.
And that was unique to the in-house model in many ways because it didn't cost any more to do it. And so in the passive service delivery model, where you call your lawyer at your law firm where they bill you hourly, it's a disincentive to use that service. It's a disincentive to engage that service provider on the front end. And I feel that that is broken in many ways. And I started thinking about, what if the rest of the world, especially the world that is increasingly paying attention to social issues and wanting to make a positive social impact, were able to engage these smart attorneys who I regard as the architects of so much of this work? Because nobody's doing it without their lawyers, whether it's on the front end or the back end. And those that are doing the front end are solving problems before they become problems. And their ounce of prevention is definitely worth the pound of cure. What if we did that at scale? And so I have this vision that lawyers in the social innovation context are the architects of social innovation, because nobody, or at least very few, are actually doing this without their lawyers. And most of them are engaging their lawyers on the front end in the design and build process. And if we can take that to scale, I think we see a new role for lawyers. We might have to change the business model, and it may not apply everywhere. There's still going to be times when you just have to run it by the lawyers, or they have to solve a problem or put out a fire. But I see a great opportunity for any business, corporate, transactional, nonprofit, or socially minded lawyer to start that work on the front end and mm-hmm. not on the back end, whether that's with a client engagement or in their own career.
I love this sort of shift in orientation. We're going to be talking to Tina Seelig, who is a professor at Stanford Engineering Department and wrote this fantastic book on creativity. And she talks about the fact that you don't just get hired for a job. When you get hired at a place of work, you're given the keys to the building. Mm. And this orientation of recognizing that, you can open many doors when you walk into this place rather than just this one specific thing. But it does require a shift in perspective that was not the guiding principle for most of us when we were taught how we were supposed to behave at work. And most of that teaching, of course, was coming from sitcom television or, you know, some other make-believe fantasy. But I even think in the various business schools, it's not necessarily the orientation that we're given.
It's not, and especially in the law, too, where yeah. you do adopt that service model of responding to client demand. It requires a mental shift for lawyers and for, in my view, the entire legal profession to regard themselves higher than they do. And not from an ego perspective, but from a client service perspective. I can do more to help the client on the front end and help avoid problems or help design and build something amazing and impactful proactively that avoids the use of my services on the back end to solve a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe the law, lawyers, law schools, the legal profession needs to start thinking about themselves, especially in the form and context of social innovation, philanthropy, what have you, as people who should be involved from day one.
Yep. I want to talk a bit about leadership and sort of work life, because you seem to touch on that as well, which is more broadly speaking than just specifically even the stuff that you talked about here. And I want to ask you why you hate the results-driven leader.
So I hate that as a phrase on a resume.
Yeah.
I recently spoke on a panel at a conference full of in-house lawyers. And the panel I was on was for career transitions. And of the four people on the panel, I was the after model. I was okay. not the before model. I was the person who has just left the in-house position at the Clinton Foundation, is now doing something different. And the rest of the folks were talking about, you know, things like networking and having a good LinkedIn profile and the like, which, again, in my view, is a little more passive than mm-hmm. my perspective. And I asked everybody in the room to raise their hand if they were not a results-driven leader. Not a single hand went up. So everybody in the room agrees you're a results-driven leader. Stop putting it on your resume. Why not just write words, 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 or I'm a human who likes to breathe air? They're empty words. Nobody ever looked at a resume and saw, oh,
he's a
results-driven leader. I need to look no further. Let's extend the offer.
Uh-huh.
It's you know, I'm a good communicator. There's a whole bunch of other phrases, which uh-huh. is, you know, adept at working alone or in groups, thrives in a fast-paced environment.
Uh-huh.
Those are empty words that were on the form you thought was good that somebody sent you.
Right. So, I mean, what you're craving for, of course, is a sense of authenticity, and that scares people. We know this from our work at Second City, because many of the people who come into our level A class, our beginning class, are not people who necessarily are looking to end up on Saturday Night Live, but are merely trying to, you know, get out of their own way or try something that'll make them better at the office, that sort of thing. And I think, you know, that requires a level of vulnerability that makes many people uncomfortable. And you must have experienced that because you took level A classes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my 1 year at the Second City Training Center taught me an awful lot about life, and I have infused it throughout almost every decision I've made in my own career path. And I left the practice of corporate law as a fifth-year lawyer, where I could finally take a day or two of vacation without somebody looking at me sideways or leave early or come in late without – and I saw – a future in my career that was lucrative and full of all kinds of opportunity, and I chose to go to Arkansas.
Why?
On a whim. I mean, it was a mild whim.
You realize no one like normally goes on a whim to Arkansas.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
And I did.
Okay.
And I loved it, and I would do it again, mm-hmm. and I would encourage other people to do the same. I mean, the short version is I became aware of a master's program in public service that really lit my fire, and all of the hurdles that were so obvious to me, which is that I wasn't going to move to Arkansas, I wasn't going to quit a job, and I had just proposed to my now wife, and we weren't going to have our salaries, double our living expenses, move to Arkansas and go to a master's program that was brand new
mm-hmm.
with no alumni, offering a master's degree in something that has never before been offered in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounded like fun.
Yeah, and you did it.
And life changed.
I bet. In an alumni panel that you noted for law students, you gave out some really great advice. First, you said that you needed to hustle, but you said be mindful and self-aware in the hustle. What do you mean by that?
just hustling alone isn't progress. A lot of people and a lot of human nature, I think, tends to mistake activity for progress. And so just being busy, just clearing an inbox, just, you know, making some progress in some area in your life, just because you were busy that day doesn't mean you've made progress. And in the entrepreneur space, and I'm only recently a new entrepreneur in the past couple of years, you hear about the hustle all the time. And I think there's a lot of people who hustle for hustling's sake. And if they feel they're hustling or what they think is hustling, they're making progress. If they're following that model of the duck, calm on the surface, but paddling like hell underneath, that they are succeeding. And I think there's an inherent bit of mindfulness that separates those who are truly hustling towards effectiveness and output from those who are hustling and feeling good about moment, just activity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that requires a level of self-awareness. It requires a brutal honesty, a willingness to take a moment, appreciate the silence, reflect, and engage, and be honest with yourself.
So you work with a lot of other lawyers.
I do.
What's the asshole lawyer ratio? Because I think there's a contention, a belief, obviously, in public society of a negative about lawyers.
Sure.
Do you find that to be true or overstated?
Yes. Partially.
Yes, being both?
Yes as to it being overstated.
Okay.
Yes, it's also true. There's assholes in every profession.
Sure are.
Unavoidable.
Yes.
I would be curious to know which ones don't have the asshole.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're everywhere. I think it is misrepresented that there is a larger number in the legal profession than not. I think that the legal profession inherently for a lot of consumers of their services involves a little bit of pain. It's expensive. They tend to be consulted during times of challenges and problems in the conventional sense. And even in the best case scenario, you know, you still have to pay a bill in almost all cases. So there's a little bit of pain and people don't love the lawyers. There's also a tendency by virtue of that service model being one where the lawyers are very often engaged on the back end of a transaction or the back end of something, where all of a sudden the lawyers come in and they're known as deal killers. Mm-hmm. They came in and killed the deal because they started asking questions that the other parties, without the benefit of the expertise of the lawyers, didn't think to ask or know to ask due to no fault of their own other than not engaging their lawyer earlier. Perhaps due to the fact that the service delivery model is broken and needs to be fixed in many ways. So lawyers come in and sometimes change the deal or you know, create complexity where there wasn't before. And it's typically for the client's protection and benefit. So there's an inherent tension in seeking the advice and counsel of a lawyer in situations like that where lawyers are either creating that tension or maybe thrive on that tension, or if it's resolving dispute, like to fight with other lawyers because it's the nature of some of them. And then there's the common perception of ambulance chasers and lawyers who serve a function that involves, you know, sometimes literal and sometimes figurative pain in a more obvious sense. And people like to look down on them and cast aspersions on them.
I should note there is one profession that is less well-liked than lawyers, right?
Yes, there is.
What's that?
Dentists. Again, on your best day.
Who wants to go to the dentist?
Nobody. Even when you're going for the best purpose, which is just a cleaning.
Yes, it
still sucks.
Somebody's
hacking away at your gums with a metal hook.
Get out of my mouth.
Yes. There's no pleasure in that process unless you're a masochist.
I was doing – this is the lawyer joke part. I was doing some research, and I came across this academic paper written by Hershey Friedman of the City University of New York. He contends that ethics can't be successfully taught in classrooms, but he thinks that humor is a way for people to learn ethics. And we've talked before about – on this podcast, we had a whole session talking about improvisation as a way to teach ethics as well. This paper is called Approaching Ethics Through Humor, Using Lawyer Jokes to Teach Business Ethics. This paper is actually filled with lawyer jokes. Do you want to hear some?
Please.
Okay. What do you throw to a drowning lawyer? His partners. What is the ideal weight for a lawyer? About 3 pounds, including the urn.
Oh.
These are terrible.
Yeah, I
think the best one is from Mark Twain. He goes, "It is interesting to note that criminals have multiplied of late, and lawyers have also. But I repeat myself." So this idea, and the author, Friedman, goes on to sort of talk about this contention in society about the lawyer, but also recognizing that by using this humor, you really are getting at this idea around, oh, one has to be careful because the stakes are so high in terms of what the lawyers are dealing with. And it reminds me of sort of the gallows humor you hear about in, you know, sort of OR situations or ER situations. And do lawyers tell lawyer jokes on each other?
Sometimes. I mean, the second part of the last of my answer to your last question is that I'm self-selected into a very positive, feel-good part of the legal profession, which is those that are working in social impact, or in the case of my past 10 years, in philanthropy. So I'm around lawyers who are excited about the work and really committed to social impact and doing good in the world. So, you know, in the transactional sense, at the big law firms, I think there is this tendency to either adopt that persona or find some comfort with it and probably transact in lawyer jokes as well. I still think even those people, other than the most jaded or the most money-driven, and I don't think those are the majority, still want to have meaning and purpose in their life. So my whole view of it is that the profession is an admirable profession, that nobody ever looked at a young person going to law school and spat on them or suggested they were a money-grubbing ambulance chaser or any other sort of disparagement you can traditionally conjure up about lawyers. I think they say, good. Mm-hmm, we need more people like you in the law.
Right.
And somewhere in the process of getting a job and graduating from law school and everything else, you sort of fall into the ranks of, quote unquote, the law, even though the profession is so diverse and is not exclusively the private practice. And it certainly isn't even the majority in big law practice. Yet big law firms tend to dominate the conversation about the profession and therefore also the perceptions about the profession. And I do think there are very real problems that the law has to figure out in that context.
Yeah. And I mean, what tends to happen, and this is not just in the world of law, is that, you know, people who do well in their jobs, they turn 50.
Yes.
And their whole outlook changes in terms of, I want to give back.
Kills me.
Yeah,
it
talk about that.
It kills me.
Yeah.
I was very fortunate. I've had a wonderful ride over the past 10 years. I'm supremely grateful for the opportunities I've had, especially at the Clinton Foundation, and where they could have given the jobs I had as part of the legal team from my earliest days to my last day as general counsel to anybody in the Clinton world who had the same or better CV and closer connections to the family. I was given an opportunity and nobody knew me from Adam, and I was able to rise and develop a wonderful, wonderful opportunity there. And I will forever be grateful and changed for that opportunity. And by virtue of the profile that resulted, I have gotten a lot of people calling me both during my time at the Clinton Foundation and since saying, I want to give back.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a lawyer too. I've been the managing partner. I built my firm. I built my practice. I built my book. I've done my bit. I've run the race. And now I want to do something meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell were you doing over the past 20 to 40 years?
Right.
Why is it an either or?
Mm-hmm.
It should be a both and from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there is blame to lay. And if there is, I don't know where to blame it. I think it's a systems problem that requires a solution across the system, from law schools to law firms to lawyers themselves, to integrate and build that the same way our private sector clients are. I mean, going back to your first question about moving from CSR to social innovation,
yeah.
Law firms too have to move from a mindset of pro bono is the way we give back. It is no longer a large enough schema to capture the ways that lawyers, law firms, and the legal profession are doing good. They have expanded beyond that, and it is time to recognize, organize, capture that. And lawyers need to take responsibility and personal accountability for having meaning in their career from day one, and that should be taught on day one of law school, which is why I wrote that blog piece
right.
for those first-year law students. It's why I sat on that panel, and the question I was responding to, which is in the blog piece, is, you are attorneys on this panel talking to these first-year law students in their first week of orientation. What do you wish somebody would have told you when you were sitting here that they didn't and that you can now tell them? And I said that your life from this point forward is that of your own design. You get to choose what you do, how you do it, and who you become as a result of it starting now. And there are very few times in your life where you have a blank slate and get to do that. And you're going to be lawyers.
Yeah.
who are the architects of so many good things in the world, in history and in present, and in people's lives and in businesses' lives and in the lives of countries, societies, and institutions. That is an awesome opportunity.
And yet they don't see themselves as the architects of their own destiny.
Mm-mm. I have to go through law school. I have to get a summer associate position, probably at a law firm or maybe mm-hmm. with a public defender, and then I'm going to fit whatever mold is out there. And that's bullshit.
Yeah, and look, it's going to be done for them. I mean, I have great faith in the generation coming up, and we're speaking, of course, of the dreaded millennials or Generation Z after them. But one of the things I love about the young people, and we get to work with them at Second City all the time, is a purpose is part of the plan. Generally speaking,
it's baked into the profession.
Yeah. And it's baked into the profession. There's no problem with this.
You're required to do good in your profession, and there's an obligation to do no harm. Kind of
the perfect setup.
Yeah. And yet we lose it and become these monotonous, droning lawyers subject to law firm life and ABA Journal and law firm jokes and lawyer jokes. And it doesn't have to be that way. I once shared with somebody at a New Year's Day brunch who said, "What do you do for a living?" And I said, "Well, I'm a nonprofit lawyer." I usually took three rounds of questioning before I revealed my employer just to avoid the upsides or downsides of it. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, they sort of dropped their mimosa and said, "Oh my God, you did it." So I said, "What?" And they said, "Somebody actually did it. Like, you hear about people wanting to be nonprofit lawyers, but you never meet any. Mm-hmm. How did you do it?" And I said, "It was actually quite conventional. I went through law school and I was a corporate lawyer at a corporate law firm, and I was just curious and open and interested in the world and people and things happening around me, including Arkansas." Mm-hmm. And I found my way into it. I didn't design it. I had no intention of going back to practicing law. And like I said, I started as an intern at 31 at the Clinton Foundation and focused on domestic programming and accidentally started the legal department that had 16 people in it when I turned over the reins to my successor 10 years later.
We have a mutual friend who's been on the podcast, Michael Slaby, who was also an intern. So he had, you know, kind of gotten out of college and done some business and realized he had maybe an interest other than the normal path and interned for Obama and then ended up becoming his CTO.
Yes.
And the other thing that Michael talked about on here was the same thing that you talked about, which is, and I'll quote from Hamilton, wanting to be in the room where it happens. Mm-hmm. And this idea that tech is also consulted late in the game. You know, so we finished everything, now go build a website.
Right.
You know, what? What? You know, I have no information other than that. And I think that this is another thing that is an antiquated idea in business, which is that somehow we have to keep these conversations closed. That to share with too many people will somehow create just a clusterfuck. Business is a clusterfuck. So I don't understand why you wouldn't want at least to hear a few more voices, because it strikes me that we never quite hear enough voices.
I totally agree. And I think that the law actually has a bigger problem than business alone. And I find it fascinating. It's a point I bring up regularly, is that there's this distinction between the private sector mm-hmm. and the law, as though the law is not part of the private sector. It's this fascinating analog that exists. It's like the private sector is the earth and somehow the law is the moon, but there's no question here. And they're inextricably linked to, and they influence one another, and they can't exist without each other in current form. But the law is a business mm-hmm. and it's part of the private sector, but it too is based on this antiquated model, whether we're talking about the private practice or in some positive ways, the judicial system and going back to the Constitution. Those are good antiquities that we want to have and honor and learn from our past as we design our future. But it is a cluster for a lot of businesses, including the law. There is this resistance to innovation that I simply don't understand, and I am hoping that the private sector clients of law firms in particular and of the future lawyers of the world will lead the way in demonstrating to their service providers that innovation must apply to you too, because you're part of this, and we're going to ask you to help us and provide a service in the process, which is why I'd like to see the law catch up. The rest of the private sector. Just like CSR is giving way to social impact and social innovation, so too must pro bono give way to social impact and social innovation in the law. And that needs to start in law schools, and it needs to go throughout the life cycle of lawyers and their legal careers and the places they'll work in it.
I'm going to ask you a yes and story, okay, which I might have pooched already, but I sense. But before that, you are a lawyer, and I think people might assume because you work for the Clinton Foundation that you're classic sort of Democrat, you know, position, which I don't know. We haven't really talked about it. But I am curious, sitting in the world we're sitting right now, where there's a lot of legal activity around things like what one would call a Muslim ban, mm-hmm, and someone might call something else. The courts feel like they're a real active player right now in what's going on in Washington these days. Do you have a POV on the last 3 weeks, which is essentially since Trump came into power?
Sure. I think it's hard to be paying attention and not have a point of view. For the record, I'm an ardent independent who loves balanced government. Cool. So it doesn't mean I don't have party-labeled preferred candidates, but some of them might surprise you. But there is no litmus test to work at the Clinton Foundation. It's just a charity. Mm-hmm. My point of view is based on being a political independent and somebody who's pretty down on the two-party system. And it's that, you know, pendulums tend to swing and they tend to right themselves. Sometimes pendulums swing too far one direction, and I think there's a danger with it swinging the other direction. I think we're seeing that now, for better or for worse, and without my opinion about any sort of value judgment of how the past 8 years went, which mm-hmm. I believe went fairly well. Mm-hmm. We saw a backlash to it, right, wrong, or otherwise. And we have the president we have. And I think we should be really careful about that. And I think there's checks and balances in our system, which is a beautiful thing and a fragile thing. I believe that the system is working, that democracy is working as the pendulum swings in a new direction. There are people slowing or working to slow that direction. I think when you see courts get involved, they're doing their job. They too are imperfect. They are subject to influence, whether those are popular, political, or otherwise. And so I think we're going to see this tension work. I think there's two important things to keep in mind. Number one, this is the way healthy democracies work. Mm-hmm. Number two, they are fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no part of the institution, in my view, that will save it from itself. And so engagement of civil society, of all interested actors, regardless of political affiliation or ideology, is essential and necessary. And I think this is a particularly tumultuous time. I think this is a particularly challenging set of circumstances that would not have been my preference. And I think we will see a lot of predictions come true that I would love nothing more than to see not come true.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people are coming to an awareness, if not an awakening, of the role they have to play in the consequences of election and fragile democracy.
Yeah. Sitting where I live, which is, you know, steeped in an art form, which is all about empathy, and a willingness to engage in a difficult conversation. The thing that makes me sad today, and I mean this for both the left and the right, is that we seem pointedly unwilling to have a shred of empathy or to engage in a difficult conversation. We're unfriending. We're blocking. We're building walls. And I know that's a loaded metaphor. But in reality, I don't know how progress happens. And we'll segue into the yes and, because this is what that's all about, which is you can't build a scene by saying no. I mean, it's just doesn't happen. And you can't even build it by just saying yes. You have to say yes and often you're yes anding something that might seem insane to you. And you know about this because you did the work, you took the classes. And I'm wondering if you pick a time in your life, and it could be work or just in your private life, when that yes and, you know, came into being in a special sort of way.
For me, it's been a part of my life, and I honestly have a hard time thinking about any place where it hasn't been a part of it. But since I was at the training center and when I was a young lawyer, it became integrated into my life philosophy. There's this program in Arkansas, and I'm going to check out the website. I found the application, and it's only 2 pages. And the application fee is only $60. I will give it a shot. Yes, I got in, and there's no way I'm going. And then the hurdles fell down, and maybe I should give it another look. I have infused into everything we do. And, you know, most legal departments, to our earlier conversation, are known as the Department of No.
Sure.
So on the intranet, for the legal department at the Clinton Foundation, the first FAQ under that section says, are you the department of no? And the answer is no. See what we did there? We will always try to find our way to yes. And so as a lawyer, early on, even before I left and wound up in philanthropy, your goal is to meet your client where they are and hopefully guide them where they want to be. And there are times when the obvious or apparent answer is no. But that's not what your client wants to hear. It doesn't mean you should. In fact, you have an obligation not to tell your client what they want to hear mm-hmm. if it's not consistent with your obligations. But maybe there's a way to say, yes, you can do that if the following is true. Mm-hmm. And then you lay out what has to be true. And sometimes it becomes clear this is not a hurdle we can clear. And so it happened for me very early in a service provider profession. But in my own life, applying those principles, or at least looking at them at every turn, deciding to leave a really high-profile organization at a time when the conventional wisdom would have had that name ascending to the highest heights of global influence and power, I chose to leave it, which was a risk. And there was a process I went through in my own mind, and as a couple, my wife and I use these principles, perhaps not always directly, but always as a part of who we are, which is that life is more interesting. It tends to be more fun. And just like in any good improv scene, it is always heightened by exploring what's possible than what's wrong with the equation or the situation. And it has profoundly influenced my life and has become a sort of comfort zone, which is that when you don't know what's going to happen next, or you don't know how this apparent setback is going to impact you in the long run, to find comfort in that uncertainty, to find value in the silence, to find the ways to view whatever has just happened or may happen as a gift, and to explore from there. It's this inherent integration of what is increasingly popular, the practice of mindfulness, mm-hmm. which I believe has been part of improv since improv existed.
Sure.
But is now mindfulness being an increasingly important and accessible part of popular culture and life, that part of improv, that mindfulness, that taking a moment, that finding something in that silence and in the gift that's been given to you, and even recognizing something as a gift, has been hugely impactful in my life.
Perfect. Scott Curran, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Working in a